I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Curzon Film Podcast. I am Jake Cunningham, and with me this week is Irene Musumeci.
Hello.
And Ryan Hewitt.
Hello.
And we're here to talk about what's probably going to be the best film of the year, really, isn't it? It's Paddington 2.
Yay!
It's got a fair claim to that title, I think, yes.
Definitely. I mean, we're laughing now, but I think it's absolutely stunning, and it will definitely be in my top 10 of the year. Just saying.
Without question.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah. Totally honest here.
A bona fide 5-star hit.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
This was 3 years ago, and this is pre-first Paddington. If you said in 3 years' time, the sequel to the film adaptation about the bear from the kids' books is going to be in the best films of the year lists, would you believe me?
I'd have said you were lying, mate. You're having me on.
Yeah.
I would have said I need to change jobs. But here we are.
Yeah, here we are, and Paddington 2 exists, and it is a great thing. But it's not the only thing we've watched this week. We've been catching up on a few things. One series in particular.
I've been binge-watching Stranger Things 2.
As have I. I've also made it through in less than 48 hours. Did the whole thing.
Yeah, I did the whole thing in the standard 9 and a bit hours. We just had a little break for a burger session, homemade, very healthy. But yeah, it was pretty fantastic to be immersed in the world of the Upside Down and the kids from Hawkins. Really enjoyable. I thought the second series was fantastic and really just pulled all the themes together. They really responded very well to the criticism of the first series. Really enjoyed the female characters in this one. Nancy, I think, is gonna go far. Really loved her. And yeah, I just thought it was a really enjoyable. It was perfect to binge watch on just before Halloween.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. It was the absolutely perfect thing to watch over that weekend. The references were there, they were back in full force. They were more sprawling than they were in the first series, I think. I think there was even some, dare I say it, Jurassic Park references in there, which was interesting one, because
it's
set in the 80s, exactly.
Yeah.
But I'm almost certain there were Jurassic Park things going on.
But this is what's interesting is that the Duffer brothers, they were not old enough to have been the age of the kids at the time of Stranger Things. I was listening to a few things of them, and they were saying that their films are 90s, so their touchstone films are Jurassic Park, and it was stuff that they were getting E.T. on video. They never saw that in the cinema, so all the films that are playing during the time of Stranger Things, they all watched on VHS. And so I think that kind of feeling of it being a TV show and being a small screen show actually comes from the fact that although it's filled with film references, is the comes from the fact they watched them on video.
Yeah, it's funny how it has such a true. It's very loyal to its period in terms of costume and the music and things like that, and yet it does play pretty fast and loose with what the Duffer Brothers, for example, would have been grown up watching. Like, it doesn't really matter when the influences were.
No.
But that's kind
it's
of
almost timeless in a way, but it's so focused on that 80s setting as well.
It plays so much on the nostalgia because you know, the key feature of nostalgia is it's a feeling that you have for something that you never really had. It's not a realistic reconstruction of that moment in time. It's sort of really playing on this idealized moment in time via everything that's happened in between. So actually, for me, it's also got a real kind of post 9/11 vibe to it, in that there's all this kind of unknown terror and things that can happen to disrupt the home. So it's really kind of seeing the 80s via the lens of everything that's happened between here and then, which I think why it's so appealing to us, particularly as a generation.
It did make me think, why do people not make a bigger deal out of Super 8? The J.J. Abrams film.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't very good.
No, because it's excellent. And it's just as good as Stranger Things.
I don't think it's quite as charming as Stranger Things. It's particularly in Series 2, Stranger Things had this new level of... It's building its own dialect, its own language, and things like Now Memories and Halfway Happy, and we've already talked about The Upside Down and the demodogs. Yeah, but then there's the demodogs.
Oh, is that the thing that's...
Ooh, you haven't got this yet.
Oh, wow. Oh,
spoiler alert.
He's not got demodogs
yet. This is Dart, isn't it? The little, bug.
Spoiler alert. Yeah. Spoiler section.
There's a bug.
But the way it's sort of building up its own mythology as well, with things like the language and things like the way that these like young kids make sense of big idea, adult ideas with...
Just like they're doing Super 8.
Yeah, they kind of do.
What is the quote? Can you quote from Super 8 that you can't? Like Stranger Things 2 is what in Stranger Things is just something about that writing that is just so true.
I think the thing that I latch onto with Super 8 is that they're making their film as well, and that's what I love is the kid who's the like the kid from the Goonies, just screaming production value.
Well, to me, that's one of the problems that I have with Super 8, because it really came from an adult point of view. It really came from a grown-up who was wanting to go back to re-experience those feelings, and that made it feel really synthetic to me, really just not very organic, or I don't know, I felt completely distanced by it.
That's so interesting, considering J.J. Abrams would have lived in that time and actually knows it, and the Duffer Brothers don't.
Yeah.
There you go.
Something more, arguably more authentic.
Yeah, true. Oh, but we're giving Super 8 a bit of a hard time, I think, on the
maybe.
Whole. But Super 8 felt very, very indebted to Spielberg.
Well, it's pretty strong.
E.T. in particular, but also all the others, and the Goonies and all that sort of thing. But Stranger Things is so much more sprawling, isn't it? And it's... references it's got.
Well, and tonally, because it's episodic, you've got the option that one episode can be more of a horror and one can be more of an adventure, and I think that's where I've just left it, is on the first episode that Andrew Stanton directed, who's done a number of Pixar films, and even that I noticed there's a lot more colour in this episode, and the way that he's actually moving the camera around, it almost feels like he's looking at it in an animated way where you're looking for kind of camera economy. And how much can I do with doing as little as possible as well? That's something that I really like, is that freedom that having each episode to give it its own life as well.
Yeah.
There's also something to be said for the fact that when you have a long form narrative, you just have so much more scope to do emotional depth. And so many of the characters in Super 8 for me really didn't have that. So there's the key storyline, which is obviously very powerful, very moving, completely in debt to Spielberg, as is a lot of Stranger Things, but there's just the opportunity to hear a lot more from all of the different characters, and the fact that, you know, for instance, like Nancy and Jonathan are given a really cool, fun storyline to delve into, meeting this kind of crazy
conspiracy theorist journalist.
Oh, yeah. This is the chat from love.
Yes.
Yeah. And then, you know, you have really minor characters like Sean Astin's character, Bob, who is just so brilliantly written, even in those tiny little bits that he has to do, bits and bobs.
That's the spin-off show.
Yeah. Oh, my God, I would totally watch that.
Like an early kids' morning education show.
Oh, yes, please. So I guess that gives you more time and more space to really explore all the different characters.
Okay.
What do you think about... There's one moment, I'm pretty sure you're there.
Okay.
When Lucas tells Mad Max what's been going on. Been going on. And she makes a comment about how this has all happened before. Your story was a bit derivative.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It has a moment of self-awareness. Stranger Things has that moment, which I don't recall happening in Series 1. Or elsewhere in Series 2, where it reflected back on itself and made a joke about how it's pulling on this nostalgia.
I think that's very carefully observed, and it sort of reminded me, it kind of is the death of Stalin to the actual Tory conference yeah. in that reality is stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
So maybe one of those moments where it kind of reflects upon itself and decides that you cannot make it up.
Yeah.
Well, it's like, it's a way of deflecting as well. I think a lot of films do try and have their cake and eat it with this intertextuality stuff and saying, oh, but we've acknowledged it, so that means that we're okay.
Yeah, we give ourselves a pass because we know we're doing it.
Yeah.
Once we get into post-nostalgia, yeah. I think we're really done now.
Right, we must move on because this is not the Stranger Things podcast. It is indeed the Paddington 2 podcast, as we shall probably be rebranding as we talk about Paddington 2 every week for the ongoing future. And I spoke to Hugh Bonneville, who plays Mr. Brown, who is Paddington's guardian. Okay.
So we're delighted to welcome Hugh Bonneville onto the Curzon Film Podcast.
Very nice to be talking to you.
So Hugh, we're here to talk about Paddington 2, and we'll travel back in time a few years to the creation of Paddington 1, when beloved children's characters like Paddington are brought to the screen. Initially, when you hear that news, it always kind of provokes some sort of anxiety, some worry. What are they going to do to it? When the script for that first Paddington dropped on your desk, did you have that same feeling?
Absolutely. My heart sank when my agent said, they want to talk to you about playing Mr. Brown in a movie version. I thought, oh no, they're going to completely spoil it, because Paddington, as you say, was a, you know, part of my childhood, certainly, and his voice and his image was sort of locked in my own imagination, and they were going to muck with it, you know, muck it about at their peril. But then, so I went to meet Paul King and David Heyman, David being the producer and Paul the writer and director. And Paul and I were sort of sitting waiting to go into David's office. And within about sort of 2 minutes, I realised that he basically was Paddington Bear, and utterly sort of beguiling and enchanting, and you would never want him to come in the way of harm at all, and you just want to protect him and all that. And this was before I'd even read the script, and then I read the script and just started laughing on page one. I think the first gag about the first thing about the carrying a small piano or
the timepiece.
Oh, the explorer bringing the timepiece. That's right. Carrying that through the jungle, I thought was hilarious. And I thought, oh, we're in pretty safe hands here. And so any nerves I had sort of evaporated fairly quickly. And of course, when you've got someone like David, who has a pedigree for taking much loved children's or family books and putting them onto the big screen, you sort of know that you've got at least two elements going well. And then as the cast came together and the design, then it sort of took on a life of its own that was very exciting.
But I suppose the odd thing must be that Paddington is a CGI character.
No, he's not. He's real. The bear is real. And there was a lot of it was frustrating but funny when all these sort of memes came out in the first film when the image of the bear had been released and people started saying that he looked rather sinister, and they did all these posters of him in things like, you know, Jaws and The Exorcist and everything else, that he was going to be this murderous bear, and people would, of course, as it always happens, you know, prejudging the film and saying it's going to be terrible, they've ruined it. And of course, we sort of knew, or stuck to the faith, that it was going to be more than that. It was going to be better than that. And even I was completely blown away when I the first little bit of footage I saw was of Paddington sticking his head down the loo and flooding the bathroom. And I was completely blown away by the quality of how that came to life. And from then on, I was completely convinced that the bear was real, and that when we came to do the second one, there was no doubt in my mind that I wasn't staring into space. I was staring at that bear that had the voice of Ben Whishaw, you know, but it's Paddington's voice. And then when I watched it again, you know, I'd completely forgotten that Paddington wasn't actually on my shoulders in the fairground scene. You know, of course he climbed off my back and onto the ground, and it's weird. It was weird. I know acting's all about projecting in some way or other, and projecting imagination, but you sort of take it to, I suppose, a different level when you're working with a bear who doesn't often come out of his trailer.
And how quickly after that first film played were you told you were getting the gang back together?
I can't remember. It was a while. I think there had been... In fact, it was Maddie Harris, who plays Judy, my daughter in the film. And she she said at the wrap party, I'll see you on the next one. So she was quite confident there was going to be a sequel, but at that stage we weren't quite sure whether it was going to, you know, how well it was going to play, but it did play so well all around the world, and so it seemed to be a bit of a no-brainer. I think I felt for Paul, because Paul King, because, you know, he's now lived with this bear pretty much for 7 or 8 years, and he needs a break, and I wasn't sure whether he was going to have the energy to do the second one. So it took him a while with Simon Farnaby to write the second one. And obviously, while you want to keep flavours of the first, and you want the audience has got expectations about the characters and how they're going to behave, you know, you want them to be familiar, but you want them to be in a new situation, and you want new characters. And I think that was a real challenge. They couldn't just set the dial back to, for example, you couldn't have Mr. Brown just going back to being a neurotic, overprotective parent, because the whole point of the first film was him breaking away from that through the addition of Paddington to his life. But I think, so in the second film, giving Mr. Brown a midlife crisis was a stroke of genius, because then there's a lot more fun to play with. I think the development of it, while, you know, it did take a while for them to tinker with the script and get the story structure right and so on, but it was worth the wait.
Yeah, well, it's so often when there's a film that is a surprise runaway success, people want to get involved straight away and you want a sequel within 12 months' time. Mm-hmm. And it's actually, I think you can see, with you've got a 3-year gap, you've actually had time to actually really care about the script and really put the time and effort in. And how do you think maybe Simon Farnaby's involvement shifted the story?
Well, that's a question I think for them, but Simon, who plays, he co-wrote the second script, but he also plays the rather peculiar security guard in both films. He of course has a great track record in from TV in particular, and The Horrible Histories, and that bonkers film Mindhorn, and he has got a wonderfully surreal sense of humour, as has Paul. So they, I think, really feed off each other, and their way of working, you know, when we went in to discuss how Mr. Brown might behave in the second film, you know, their ideas for him and the way they bounce off each other is really great fun. They're very good at taking things to a ludicrous extreme and then reining things back to being on the edge of credibility. So that process, I think, was very important to them. And they work with other writers as well. You know, they bounce, you know, because they come from that rich seam of comedic writers, that they, you know, would bounce ideas around each other. And then you've got a lovely selection of cast who came to play, and there was, you know, some fantastic British actors who just come and play for the day, so to speak, from Richard Ayoade and Mira Sayal and Ben Miller and all these wonderful household figures from our TV screens. So bringing them into the mix and their ideas as well, of how to, you know, bolster the characters and bolster the narrative. That's the great thing about Paul and Simon. They're very collaborative, and that's the mark of a great producer is to not breathe down everyone's neck and to let people have their head, let people run with what they're good at. And that's what David is very, I think, astute at doing, is getting people who really know what they're doing and trusting them, so long as they're not sort of taking private jets everywhere and blowing the budget. But, you know, allowing people to have that creative freedom. And a number of times Paul would say, this scene isn't working and it's my fault, I haven't written it right, we'll come back to it another day. And rather than going, don't be ridiculous, that's, you know, several hundred thousand billion trillion pounds that's going down the drain, you know, David would say, okay, let's have a see if we can work around that, but we will have to lose that element, or, you know, we can't therefore do that. And Paul, they discuss it, and they, you know, there was never any sort of tension over that. It was just a way of how do we make this the best it can possibly be. And that's, you know, it's great to be around that atmosphere.
Yeah, well, it seems like there's so much love and care that's been put into the film. I was watching the first one again, and notice the first thing that we hear Mrs. Brown say is that she had just been swimming in the Wool Museum pool. Mm. And it's kind of just a bit of a throwaway thing. And then that in this second film, that's turned into a plot point, really, yeah, her yeah. swimming. And then the fact that Judy's first time that she bonds with Paddington is over a newspaper. And again, now we're learning a bit more about them.
Yeah, well, that's right. And what could have just been character traits or character quips actually become really central to the or important points in the story. So you see Jonathan in the first film, who's got this love of sort of Meccano and mechanical engineering, and, you know, by the second film, he's he's into steam trains. He knows how steam trains work, but it's not cool at school to reveal that. So he adopts this persona of J-Dog. And of course, by the end, it's sort of when it's important, when it matters most, he can reveal his real skills. So I love that each of these little, and again, Judy's journalism and Mr. Brown's midlife crisis and the way he's coping with it actually comes a bit of, you know, important part of his own plot, that it saves him when it his newfound love of chacrobatics, as we call it, saves him when the chips are down.
Yeah, he's gone on a bit of a journey of self-exploration in the last couple of years since the first film.
He has, well, as I say, because they couldn't just reset the dial to being just a neurotic, so to have him going through this midlife crisis, which of course I haven't had myself yet, you know, I'm being in my early 30s, so I aged up for the film, and to see Mr. Brown thinking, oh my goodness, I'm over the hill, it's all good, life has passed me by and I'm beginning to creak, and so he tries to, he gets fit and tries to embrace his chacrobatics, and it's fun. It was a lot of fun to play with that.
And so something that when I was looking up the history of Paddington, an interesting thing that I thought of was that when the Channel Tunnel was first connected between Britain and Europe, the first thing that was passed over from Britain to France was a Paddington bear.
No. Oh, that's enchanting. I didn't know that. Yeah. That's a lovely story. Gosh.
So, how would you interpret the meaning of that gift?
That's interesting. I suppose, if you really want to drill down into it, I would say that Paddington, who is seen to be so iconically British, is of course from somewhere else. And I think the handing on or the handing over of someone who's been a stranger in a strange place to a new, touching, reaching out to a new continent. Well, I think that's a nice little symbol in there somewhere.
Excellent. Well, Hugh Bonneville, Mr. Brown, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that was Hugh Bonneville, who I spoke to on the 36th floor of the Shard building.
Wow. Ooh.
Yes. Which makes an appearance
in Paddington 2.
How meta.
They really thought about it. I was handed a number 2 shaped marmalade sandwich.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. That's brilliant.
Yeah. So I hope you enjoyed that chat. Now let's talk about Paddington 2. So this film, it was announced in April 2015, which actually gave us kind of a 6-month purgatory from the release of the original, because I thought it would be like, you made that first one, you're going straight in. And normally, as I said in the interview, when you have a runaway success like that, you're turning around and trying to crank out a Bad Mums 2 and get out within 12 months. But this is not. This is 3 years of love and care put into it.
Are you saying this is not Bad Bears 2?
Bad Bears 2. What are you going to do?
He's actually a pretty good bear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's the most honest, sincere little bear of all time. I think.
Best bear.
Yeah. He's better than Pooh Bear, Winnie the Pooh.
Definitely. What other bears? Baloo is pretty good.
Well, I mean, from the poster of Yogi Bear, as the tagline says, great things come in bears.
Yeah.
And that's all you need to know. And there's nothing that you could read into that would make that sound weird. but
there have been some bad bears, though.
There are bad bears. There are, right? Yeah. Sounds like you've got some experience.
No,
Grizzly
Man. Grizzly Man, of course. Sorry. Yeah.
That's a double.
That was a real bad bear. There are the Bad News Bears.
Oh,
and
brilliant!
Bad news.
Yeah.
I love that film. I used to watch that repeatedly. I even pretended I faked illness from school to watch the final episode of the TV adaptation of the Bad News Bears, and I was sick and I had to stay at home and watch it. What a shame.
Did
it was fantastic. I did not see the remake, but I can tell you something about the original, which is that Jackie Earle Haley is in it.
Is he?
He plays the bully boy who turns out to be a pretty awesome pitcher.
Wow. Rorschach himself.
There you go. That's
did
Rorschach's
not
childhood.
Bad News Bears was a prequel to Watchmen.
An origin story.
What a story. That series before Watchmen was inspired by Bad News Bears.
This podcast is taking place in a very strange multiverse where Paddington, the Bad News Bears, Watchmen, and Stranger Things coexist.
Yeah.
And I totally watch this.
Oh, yeah. That is a crossover show.
Yeah.
We're going to have Samuel L. Jackson appear at the end of Paddington 2, and so it's time to talk about the Ozymandias project.
I'm sick of these effing bears and these plane. This should be cut, by the way.
Yes, yeah, I'm sure. But Paddington 1, we all loved. It came as a, what was nice about Paddington 1 is that no one expected it to be great, because it's a beloved childhood character who gets brought to screen, and 9 times out of 10, it's going to be horrible. But this time we got the ingredient of David Heyman, who brought all the Harry Potters to the screen. And so we have some element of trust there. And for me, this was a real great surprise. I actually didn't watch it when it was in cinemas. It was like, I watched it in June and completely fell for it then. And I've just been so excited since.
I watched the original in the cinema at the time of release around Christmas, and it was absolutely magical. We were surrounded by kids who were totally mesmerized and completely involved in the emotional stakes of the story, which is fantastic because it's not just action. And there's a real depth to it. And I think what really struck me is we were sat next to this family of Spanish-British kids, and they were kind of speaking in two languages to their mom and dad, and they were really just totally latching on to the multiculturalism of the story and the atmosphere.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And how much it reflects, I think, quite a lot of real London in a way, even though it's so magical and kind of fantastical pop-up book London. Yeah. But there's an element to it that is very recognisable and very true, which is, you know, just the coexistence of so many different people.
Well, as D-Line, the band that appear in the film and in the sequel, they say the first song they sing in the first film, London is the place for me.
There you go.
And I think that's the case for everyone in the film, and it's kind of about finding a home and finding their place within a home or a family unit as well. And where we join Paddington 2, he's very much a staple of the Brown household and of Windsor Gardens, the street upon which they live. And I think Paddington's kind of inherent goodness seems to be spreading out of London as well. Not out, but further outside of Windsor Gardens to the rest of London. And we see him kind of catching the bus and helping the dustbin man and helping a lady with her lunch. And he's just kind of spreading this joy.
That opening, it's not the opening, is it? But that scene where he rides around the Winter Gardens is just utterly charming, and it sets out the stable of, well, we're going to be here, what Paddington means to everybody. And you can see how he is just infecting everybody's lives with, what you say, just pure like happiness. They're not really changed, but he just makes life easier and better for them.
And there is a moment, we won't spoil it, but there's a moment where we see a mirroring of the same scene that's without Paddington, and you can see exactly what he's brought to them, and they don't realise it. And that's how good he is, because he's not doing it to be told, Paddington, you're an amazing bear. He's doing it just because it's the right thing to do. And we get introduced to a lot of new characters. So we've got regulars of British TV in Jessica Hines and Ben Miller and Sadie Pascal, all getting added to this London street, and it's really lovely. And they all get their own little story.
It's so much fun, that opening, when it's the who's who of British TV and film talent, and it's almost, it could be cameo overload, but it's not. It's just
this
a charming moment, building upon moment upon moment upon moment, and it runs for a minute or maybe a minute and a half of just people saying hello, and you know who every single face is.
Yeah,
and it's somehow totally not cheesy either, is really a testament to the quality of the filmmaking in this one.
And after we have all this screen royalty, there is one that tops it all, which kind of begins our plot, which is the introduction of Phoenix Buchanan.
Oh, what a glorious, glorious, glorious performance from Hugh Grant. I did not think that he had it in him. You know, some of my favorite actors are pretty renowned, kind of dramatic, tragic actors like Ralph Fiennes. But I always knew that Ralph Fiennes had comedy in him before the Grand Budapest Hotel. And Hugh Grant, I really just did not see the level of kind of self-awareness in a way, because he's really standing up a certain kind of actor, which I'm pretty sure he has been for a little while. But also like all of these kind of these transformations into the various different acts and characters that he's playing. He's trying to do his Laurence Olivier here, guys, and this is a performance worthy of many, many Olivier Awards and many BAFTAs. All of them given to him. Yeah. That's it. Category
just
done.
Go back and strip like BAFTAs off of people just to
retrospectively.
So I must say how Hugh Grant actually ties into the plot here. I don't think anyone's going into Paddington to get the like intense plot of what's going on. There is a treasure hunt to find a book, because Paddington has been told that the book is very valuable and it's a pop-up book of London, and because his aunt, now the home for retired bears, obviously.
In Peru.
Darkest Peru. She's never seen London, so he wants to save money by being a window cleaner, amazing sequence as well, to buy this book and send it back to her so that she can see London. But this is also the pop-up book owned by Hugh Grant's character's granddad, who ran a fair ground, and somewhere in the fairground is loads of money, and he needs money because he's doing dog food adverts.
Well, he murdered someone and stole her treasure.
Yes,
the granddad did, didn't he?
Yeah. And in the pop-up book are the clues. He attempted to steal the treasure. The treasure was then safely guarded by the person who owned it. And in the pop-up book are the clues as to where the treasure may be kept.
And they are all across London in these lovely London world. And it just means that this whole film is like the ultimate red bus tour around the city. And when we delve into the book, we don't just, like, this book is like, we actually get to live in it for a bit, and that may be the best sequence in the film, like this lovely stop motion pop-up bit.
And we go into the pop-up book,
and we Paddington opens the book and he imagines him and his aunt Lucy walking through these London landmarks, and it's amazing. It's so lovely to look at. And you said to me before we started recording, this maybe has hints of Simon Farnaby, who was of the Mighty Boosh, who was in the first film as an actor and has now joined this film as a writer.
And as a cameo in the film as well.
And in the first one as well. The security guard.
In both.
So what do you think that Farnaby brings? Because I kind of touched on it with Hugh Bonneville in the interview, but I think he said that's more of a question for them. But do you think you see some of that weirdness of the Mighty Boosh coming in?
I think absolutely, yeah. I think Mighty Boosh has a certain, it's not fair to say like juvenile, but it is a bit juvenile sometimes in its humour, but it has a irreverence to it. But the gags,
it's not tacky, it's kind of wacky.
Yeah, it's wacky and it's silly and it's goofy. And I think Paddington has a lot of goofy gags in it, but it nails them, it sells every single one with its just its warmth and its sense of adventure and magic, which Boosh kind of got away with as well, because they just bought into the weird and wonderful world they were creating.
But I think for me, Boosh didn't always land.
Maybe towards the end. In its first couple of series, I think it was up there with some of the best British comedy there's been, but take your point there.
Yeah, I think because Paddington is established before them that they know exactly the tone they need to hear. And I think, like, they've tried so hard to make it look this easy. And Irene, you're saying that there's another director or touchstone that you think is coming through a bit stronger in this film as well compared to the first one.
Well, for me, there's a major Wes Anderson influence on the film, particularly in the sequences that take place in the prison, which kind of refer back to the Grand Budapest Hotel quite, you know, sincerely and as a clear loving homage at the point where... first of all, the first thing that happens is Paddington is meant to do the laundry. Paddington is sent to prison, first of all, for a crime he did not commit. And this should be clarified. And the crime that he's accused of is stealing the pop-up book that we were talking about earlier. So once he gets into prison, he's given his uniform and he's on laundry duty, and the first thing that happens is, you know, he tries to do the laundry, and then completely by accident a red sock gets into the washing machine. Red socks have a tendency to do this, I find, in life. So yet another great realist moment in Paddington. And unfortunately, all of the uniforms for the very butch macho dwellers of the prison, all of their uniforms are turned pink, which starts off this kind of brilliant series of nods to the Grand Budapest Hotel, which is a film absolutely drenched in this pink before millennial pink was a thing. And then subsequently Paddington teaches Brendan Gleeson's character, who is the chef called Knuckles.
Knuckles McGinty.
Who is so hard and so tough and no one dare complain about the horrible porridge that he makes. And Paddington teaches him how to make marmalade, and this wins everybody over. And Knuckles discovers that he's got a real knack for pastry, and it gets everyone involved, and everyone starts to make these absolutely like acrobatic baking these exercises that just send the best British Bake Off into misery. I would say, you know, they just probably all win X equal best. What do they win? Best baker on the British Bake Off?
Star baker.
There you go. There's a lot of references there to Mendel's pastries and chocolates in the Grand Budapest Hotel, but also a sensational prison escape sequence, which nods again back to the Grand Budapest Hotel. But on top of that, there's more of a sort of Wes Andersonian touch, I think, in the way the film deals with childhood and the experience of childhood, in that I find that there's a again, you know, nostalgia in a certain sense, and at the same time it's a nostalgia for a time that never existed. This place is pretty much made up, but it's a place where goodness is allowed to live and really shine through, which is the joy of it. So there were little sort of nods here and there, I think, to the Wes Anderson world. And I'm sure that Paddington 3 will have a lot more corduroy as the kids grow up to be hipsters, really.
Cause... Yeah, and maybe some Willem Dafoe having his fingers chopped off.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's what this film's missing, I thought.
Willem Dafoe is superb at the Really Gentle Comedy in Florida Project, by the way, so he'd be perfect.
Yeah.
He's ready.
Week as well, so
yeah.
Do make sure you check that out too whilst you're listening. When that prison escape happens, that we end up with this lovely constructed balloon, and we kind of move over London, and it kind of got me thinking. I think Paddington is pretty much, I think maybe I might come at it from a perspective of Paddington's an immigrant who's been welcomed into a country and he's improved it by that fact. But a lot of people maybe watch the film and think this is a very story about the kind of best of Britain, and this is a Britain where people still use red telephone boxes and lovely skyline shots over England. And I think that shows just how much of a diverse audience that this film is actually going to reach and is enjoyable for. I think this is like an ultimate family film, and kind of releasing it now as well, at exactly the time when you're going to be bringing grandparents to the cinema. There is no way that I can see anyone not enjoying it.
Yeah, I think you make a good point about the inclusivity of it, and Peter Capaldi's character is very much the fool guy for any, you know, unpleasant idea about people coming.
Variety. The critic just called his character Brexit.
He's like an embodiment of that ideology, isn't he? And the film does a really nice job, I think, of skirting alongside those kind of issues, shall we call them, without going too heavy-handed on them, because essentially this is a kid's film, but it isn't pretending that that isn't, you know, the world we live in. But it's very British, but it's also...
It's not sickening at all.
No.
And I think it's like it's got that old BBC mantra of inform, educate, entertain as well.
Yeah.
And there's for me, if I was kind of, I don't know, between the ages that the kids are, what do you think, like between 8 and 13, 14, they kind of inspire you to learn as well. Like you watch it and you think, God, print media, that's great. Judy, who... in the first film is kind of like on the verge of becoming a grumpy teenager. In this one, she's established a student newspaper and she's bought a printing press and she's making that herself. And Jonathan has developed from making Meccano to actually getting well into steam trains. And
that's exactly what I meant about the Wes Anderson touch, you know, with representing the children and the kind of young teens. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of Moonrise Kingdom element there, with the kids kind of being obsessed by very specific retro vintagey type things. So the printing press and the steam engines, and it's lovely actually. The Jonathan's arc through the film is really quite fun, in that at the beginning he's kind of this quite a nerdy teenager who's into steam engines, but he's pretending that he's really J-Dog, a rapper, and a really cool guy who walks around with like neon plastic sunglasses.
Wow, he looks cool.
He looks so cool. And there's another kid who kind of gives him a sort of dab and goes, yeah, man.
Was it a dab?
I don't know. I think it was a dab.
Oh, also. Yeah.
And, you know, by the end, there's this lovely narrative with Jonathan where actually he manages to trigger, one of the best sequences in the film, which is the fantastic train chase in search of lost treasure, also inspired by
Indiana Jones.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you've got Hugh Bonneville doing his super yoga.
That's brilliant too. But then, you know, there's this really great kind of moment of acceptance where Jonathan says, my name is not J-Dog. My name is Jonathan and I love steam engines.
Yeah.
And I think actually that's very much in the spirit of inform, entertain and educate, in the sense that it's really inspiring kids to be who they are and really to just kind of say, if you're interested in stuff that's uncool, don't worry, just be yourself and someday you might just find treasure.
Yeah, and you do come out of it thinking, whatever it is you're doing, you feel more passionate about it. And it's the Paddington effect that he has on his street and on his city, we end up getting as soon as you walk out the door.
Yeah,
I think.
Absolutely. It's so, everyone was so moved in the screening I was at. And there's going to have to be a bit of disclosure here in that Ryan actually cried. He was
did you as well?
Excellent.
I cried at the opening.
That's brilliant.
On the bridge.
Yeah, when Paddington's Origins.
Oh, that was so
that's
moving.
Like,
no,
that's like,
it was like mild peril.
What?
Come on.
That was really moving. That was really terrifying,
yeah,
I think, at the beginning.
Yeah, fairly.
I was gone. I was
Uncle
Paddington. I'm really bad at crying.
So, parents.
I mean,
parents,
I don't cry easy, but
take your adult sons.
Yeah.
Take your adult sons to see Paddington and they will be reduced to a puddle of tears.
They will have fully formed tears.
And then there's an epilogue.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, soften any kind of heart and soul like yourself, Ryan.
Paddington isn't touched by that kind of cynicism that I'm touched with. He's just
he's inspiring
pure,
you, isn't he?
True north.
He's got into you a bit, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has. He's so good. And good. He's goodness.
Yeah, he is.
Embodied. And it's just
furry.
Impossible not to feel for that little guy. He's not from the current the trend that feels like kids in films are very precocious and they very wiser than the years, always cracking gags and things like that, and they fit in with adults, and which is very fun to watch. But there's something about a bear who is essentially a child of maybe 8 or 9 years old. I don't know how exactly how he is, but I mean, he's like an 8-year-old little kid who
very skilled
doesn't. Yeah, he is. Apart from
a toothbrush.
Yeah, not so skilled with a pair of barbershop clippers, though.
Ooh.
My absolute favourite scene.
Tom Conti has a number of cameos in which he suffers completely at the hands of Paddington a number of times, which is a great recurring joke. And that's one of many jokes that kind of get set up in the first few minutes of the film, and they pay off at the end. Like, there's like no bit of information is wasted. That's the amazing thing about it.
It's very economical with the storytelling also, because it's got a really nice, you know, curt running time, so it doesn't have any extra padding, so it's very
extra.
Good. Extra Paddington. I would have loved some extra Paddington.
Yeah.
But one thing I wanted to add to that, in that, you know, the representation of Paddington is absolutely excellent, not just by narrative and dialogue, but also the animation is extraordinary.
Yeah.
His eyes are so expressive that I think a lot of the job of, you know, getting the viewer to really emote with what Paddington is going through has to do with the excellence of that.
I mean, and there's when he gives scary Brendan Gleeson.
Oh yeah.
Wow, what a moment that's just fantastic.
Yeah, I watched Paddington 1 again this week, and there's a great bit in that where he holds on to the cistern of a toilet, and just as it falls down, he kind of looks to one side, and you just see the whites in his eyes, and you instantly see that kind of worry and
it's absolutely brilliant. Yeah. His eyes are just.
But even in that short span of 3 years since the last one, that he looks better. Like the fur is actually a bit more realistic.
Yeah.
It feels a bit more textured.
Does he age?
I'd like to think he's immortal.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Of course. Are you suggesting that Paddington will die at some point? No.
Can you imagine if they killed Paddington?
Well, you mentioned immortality here. Of course he's immortal. But just, I wonder if he's actually grown up a bit with the kids. Because that's what
I
was going to happen.
I think, well, in this one he gets a job, which I think is...
Yeah.
Yeah, he's certainly maturing, isn't he?
Yeah. And actually, something that I do want to point out is he works at Gruber's, the antique shop.
Mm-hmm.
They really need to sort out their security. Because in the first film, a guy also steals a wallet from Gruber's, and Paddington goes on another chase. And the guy that steals it is Superhands from Peep Show.
Is it?
And so, yeah, Gruber's needs to just employ a guy on the door. Because now people stealing from that antique shop has kind of been a plot point that has begun two films now.
Gruber is also a brilliant character, and the character of Gruber kind of really taps into this notion of accepting the person who comes in from outside, possibly from a very dangerous situation, because Gruber is actually based on... Gruber himself is suggested quite heavily in the first film that he is a child who came to Britain as part of the Kinder Transport, which were the trains that were run to save, to rescue Jewish children from persecution in Nazi Germany. So that's kind of, actually, I think that's very much a backstory of the author who wrote Paddington. He certainly deliberately wanted to tap into this thing. I don't know how much it relates to his biography.
Because I think the explorer that meets Paddington in the first one as well, they talk about how during the war there were children who were taken out of unsafe places and sent along, and families would take them in. And I think that's very... into that there.
So the idea of Paddington as a refugee is very much resonant to the origin of the story, but also the ethos of the educational piece that goes into Paddington.
And he arrives in town with the tag around his neck that just says, "Please look after this bear."
Yes.
It's lovely. And at the screening I was at, each seat had a tag around it that just says, "Please look after each other."
So
I've taken that, and I've currently just got that tied around my desk.
That's so sweet.
Speaking of things that are sweet, Irina, it sounds like you've got a fascinating marmalade story to share.
Well, I don't know if this is a fascinating story. It's 99% apocryphal, I'm sure, but I was told that the origins of the word marmalade came from the time when Mary Queen of Scots, who was French, had arrived in Scotland and was ill in bed and needed a concoction that was usually made for her in France back when, in the continent, and it was a concoction made from cooked citrus fruit and oranges, which at the time were an absolute luxury, and it was, you know, essentially a jam made from marmalade, and it was brought to Marie, who was malade, hence the origin of the word marmalade. So sorry to refer back to our "Call Me by Your Name" favorite line. I just wanted to talk etymology for a second. I think this is probably just a lie, but it is quite a nice story, and it's lovely that marmalade, which was probably not invented in Britain, has become almost synonymous with Britishness, which kind of ties into, again, this notion of Paddington as a quintessentially British story. But marmalade as a concept is a pretty pan-European thing. And
well, what's your favourite thing to have marmalade with, Ryan?
I don't actually like marmalade at all.
Shocking.
What are you doing on this podcast, Brennan?
Toast.
Toast.
With butter and marmalade.
So you're talking about pan-European condiments. I'm the only one eating it with croissants.
Oh, that's excellent.
It's the best.
There's a place in my hometown in Italy where they do a blood orange croissant.
Oh, right.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, that does sound good. You often get marmalade in those little preserve pots, don't you?
You do, Ryan.
Yeah.
You do.
It's often in there. It's a staple of preserve of choice.
That's like your travelogue breakfast.
Yeah,
That's what you're going to get.
You have a...
Well, another apocryphal story about marmalade that I was told recently is that marmalade was invented in Oxford. And I think this is to do with Frank Cooper's marmalade being one of the most renowned brands. But I don't actually think that's true. However, what is true is that we're going to be bringing Paddington 2 to Oxford very soon. We've got a brand new cinema opening on the 17th of November, which is in 2 weeks' time. And we really can't wait, actually. We've got a lovely campaign that has Paddington all over it. So Oxford is full of it.
Extra padding.
I'm sure they will by the time we're there. But actually, our little Paddington that we keep here in the office, which is a lovely gift from the distributors of Paddington, Studio Canal, is currently in Oxford, welcoming people over to the entrance of the new cinema as we do some building works.
That's just giving me a flashback to somewhere that I think it might be my dentist as a kid had a giant Paddington and you put a coin in his hand.
Oh yeah,
as a charity.
Oh,
yeah,
yeah. I remember those. Yeah,
yeah, they were everywhere.
That's
they?
Lovely.
Yeah, yeah, that was a charity. Paddington, he's just always doing good.
He's
the
best
object.
He's absolutely the best.
Yeah. Right, so just go and watch Paddington. I mean, this chat's gone on long enough. Just watch it. If you somehow need to watch something else that isn't Paddington, Marjorie Prime is on Curzon Home Cinema. I haven't had the chance to watch it yet, but the thing that's got me really excited is the music is by Michael Levy, who did the score for Jackie and for Under the Skin, two of the most amazing pieces of film music in the last couple of years. And that's going to be available to watch on demand on Curzon Home Cinema. So do go and watch that as well. But I think that's probably about it. Until Paddington 3, I suppose.
Oh, we'll get... I can't wait.
Can't wait, yeah.
Can't wait. All right, well, it's goodbye from Irena.
Bye.
It's goodbye from Ryan.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from me.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.